Ms. Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be here to help moderate our session today. Before we begin the technical portion of the broadcast today, I'm going to go ahead and cover a couple of housekeeping and reminder items just to make sure that everybody is familiar with how the session will run, how you can hear the materials, download copies of the slides, as well as actually ask questions with our presenters today. We do have a number of individuals who are asking for call-in information very quickly, so I'm going to go ahead and provide that number very quickly to a few individuals who are having issues, and then we'll go ahead and begin the formal instructions. So with that, our entire broadcast today is actually going to be delivered online through Adobe Connect. I would encourage you, if you're not one of our speakers, please go ahead and put your phone line on mute. You'll want to keep yourself muted to help cut down on background noises. And I can hear someone speaking right now, so I have a global mute command I can turn back on, but I just want to ask one last time, if you're on the phone lines, please keep your phone muted to help cut down on background noises. Thank you very much. As we were saying, the entire session today is going to be delivered online through Adobe Connect. So when you come into the online environment, if you haven't done so already, I'd encourage you to please do that. If you've just downloaded a copy of the slides, there's some interactive components that you'll miss out on if you're not joining us live through the Adobe Connect interface. So if you just hopped on and you haven't joined us online, I'd encourage you to refer back to your seminar registration and confirmation email messages. They should have a link to something called the seminar homepage. On that homepage, you can see a complete description of the event, download copies of the presentation materials, look for contact information and bio for all of our presenters and organizers. And on that same page, there's a big button in the upper left corner that says Go to Seminar. If you click that, that'll actually prompt you to identify yourself, indicate how many people are with you, and will actually bring you into the live online broadcast. Once you've joined us online in the live online broadcast room, you'll see a series of windows open in front of you. The main portion of your screen will be occupied with a presentation slide deck. So everyone who's online should be looking at slide number 2, our housekeeping slide. And our presenters will be controlling what you see and actually moving through these materials. By default, online audio is available through the Adobe Connect room for all participants. So everyone can actually listen to us through your computer or mobile device speakers. Occasionally, we have participants who have problems with the online audio. If you do, I'd encourage you to first take a look at your local volume settings. You may simply find that adjusting the speaker volume or going into the sound control panel and increasing your volume output helps. Also, sometimes wearing a pair of headphones improves the quality. If that still doesn't work and you're having a problem hearing your speakers, we have toll-free call-in information. We'll be happy to share that with anybody who needs the call-in number. Simply type a message into one of the other windows you see in the lower right corner called Q&A, and I'll be happy to share the call-in number with anyone who needs it. By default, all participants are in a listen-only mode, and we'd ask that you remain, especially if you're on the telephone lines, on that global mute to help cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. If you have questions or comments and you'd like to submit them, you can use that Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. You simply type a question at the very bottom and hit the little cartoon bubble, and that will privately submit your comment or question. Michelle and I will build up a solid question queue, and when we get to the appropriate times for Q&A with our presenters, I will actually read the questions out loud on your behalf so our presenters can answer them. Our seminar today is being recorded, as was part one with the seminar workshop, and we'll go on with part three for the seminar workshop. You will automatically receive an email message once these archives are available for free replay and download from the CLUIN website. If you like what you're seeing here today, we have more than 500 recorded archives that you can currently browse on our archive page. So just one quick reminder again, you should see the presentations live and in real time here in the majority of your screen. If you're having any problems viewing the content that's being displayed, you can press the full screen button that appears in the upper right corner of that window, and that will actually temporarily expand the size of the slides. Once you're done looking at them, you can press the full screen button again, and it'll shrink the slides back down to the normal view. If you want to control your online audio, there's a little speaker. Should be shaded bright green if you're listening online, and that'll actually allow you to adjust the volume or turn the online audio off if you prefer to listen just by telephone. You'll see a live video image appear here. You'll see a collection of related websites here. You can actually click on any one of those websites, press the Browse To button, and then actually open those websites up on your own computer. You'll find the seminar homepage is really your one-stop shop. If you're looking for copies of the presentation materials or contact info, I'd encourage you to look at the homepage first. And then lastly, just below in the bottom right corner, there's the Q&A window. You can submit your comments, questions, and technical issues right here. And I'd encourage you to submit those questions and comments at any time, so that we can go ahead and build up a healthy queue and answer as many questions as possible in the time that we have allotted. So I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's broadcast. And I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to my co-moderator, Michelle Mahoney. Michelle?
Great. Thank you, Jean, so much for orienting us and getting us started. I'm Michelle Mahoney. As Jean mentioned, I'm co-moderating today's webinar. I work in the same office as Jean in the Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. And our office has worked with our EPA office in Region 10 and the Office of Research and Development to bring you this series of webinars on hard rock mine geochemistry and hydrology. Hopefully you all had a chance to join us last week for the first workshop. That was the first of three. Today we're on workshop number two. Our first workshop that was delivered on February 13th is available as an archive, which you can navigate to through the URL resources here in the Adobe Connect room. Workshop number one, we talked about evaluating water chemistry predictions at hard rock mine sites. And today's webinar, we're going to talk about mining-influenced water pathways for off-site releases. We have three speakers today. We will have Connie Travers and Mike Wireman each speak for 35 minutes. As you can see, their lectures are summarized here on this agenda slide. And then we'll have Bob Thompson present for about 15 minutes. After each presentation, we're going to have about 5 minutes for questions and answers. And that's why we encourage you throughout Connie's presentation and Mike and Robert's presentation, please continue to submit questions in the Q&A pod that Jean showed you in the bottom right-hand corner of today's room. And that way, when we get to the question period, we'll be able to, quickly be able to start into the discussion with the speakers. And we have planned to have an additional time at the end of today's webinar to kind of follow up on anything we might not have gotten to during the presentations. So with that, I think we're ready to kick off today's webinar. I'm going to give some, looks like Jean's taking care of things. So Connie, you should be getting your presenter rights coming up soon here. And I know that you want to start your webcam.
Yep, Connie.
Starting it.
Beautiful. And we can see you.
Excellent. Great. So I just want to give a very brief introduction for Connie so everyone knows who she is. Connie is a hydrogeologist with 17 years of experience in hydrogeology, water resources, and environmental chemistry. She has extensive experience in the development, testing, and application of numerical models used in predicting the mobility of water and inorganic and organic contaminants in the subsurface, as well as surface water. She's worked at sites throughout the United States. She's primarily focused on subsurface fate and transport issues to support site characterization, remedial investigations, and feasibility studies. And we're very excited to have you be part of our webinar series, Connie. So it's all you.
Thank you. I wanted to thank everyone for attending this webinar. This is the first time I've ever done a webinar with this kind of a audience, so bear with me. I should be able to. So I'm going to talk about hydrologic characterization at mine sites. I'm going to talk about near-surface hydrology and water balance issues and groundwater characterization and surface water. And then I'll talk about the impacts of mine facilities and operations on hydrologic processes and pathways. We'll talk about the different types of mine facilities and also operations of mines dewatering and how those change recharge and flow paths and discharge. So with near surface processes, you are looking at basically the hydrologic cycle. We have a little picture here in the upper corner. And you have precipitation falling on the land surface, and then you can have that partition between runoff on the surface, evapotranspiration or evaporation from water bodies, and then infiltration into the ground, which then becomes recharge when it reaches the water table. Typically at mine sites, the only parameter that's measured is precipitation. There are ways to measure runoff and to evapotranspiration, infiltration, but generally at mine sites you have measurements of precipitation and estimates of the other parameters in the water balance, the runoff, evapotranspiration, and infiltration. So precipitation data typically comes from meteorological stations, either regional stations or ones that are maintained by the mine. The kind of data you can get from those are precipitation data, temperature, wind speed, pan evaporation often can also be stations. And with that data, you need to be considering the amount and frequency, duration, and intensity of the individual precipitation events, as well as long-term variability in precipitation. You need a long-term continuous meteorological data record to understand the water balance at a mine site. And often, these kind of data records are not available at remote mine sites, particularly during the pre-mining period. So often when you're in the permitting phase, you may have only a couple years of precipitation data to be working from, and that may not capture all of the long-term variability that you might see. The other thing to consider is that at many mine sites, there are orographic effects on precipitation. In other words, precipitation varies with elevation. So this is an example from the Big Springs mine in Nevada as a hydrologic evaluation that we did there for the Forest Service. And these black dots, if you can see them, are actual met station measurements of precipitation. The other data values are model values using PRISM. And what's important to see here is that the met stations are actually down at the lower elevations, and the mine is actually located more in the range where the precipitation is more 20 to 25 inches, and then there's also parts of the catchment that drain into the mine that have higher elevations up in the mountains. And so if you are looking at data only at the met stations that are down in the valley floor, you're going to dramatically underestimate the precipitation that would be falling on the watershed. So it's important to look at potential variability in the precipitation data with elevation. So now I'm going to talk a little about recharge and infiltration. So there's two kinds of recharge that you're interested in when you're characterizing the hydrology for a mine site, diffuse recharge and focused recharge. Diffuse recharge is the recharge that you have widespread recharge coming from precipitation incident on the land and infiltrating into the ground. Focused recharge comes from surface water bodies. So if you have a stream and you have discharge of that stream to the groundwater system, that's a focused recharge. And you need to characterize both of those to understand the hydrology of the mine site. So methods for estimating recharge, and this is a list from Rick Healy at the USGS from his book on estimating groundwater recharge. Most commonly, water budget methods are used to estimate recharge. So the recharge is equal to the precipitation measured at meteorological stations or modeled or estimated in some other manner, minus the evapotranspiration losses, minus the runoff, and minus any change in storage in the system. There are also modeling methods people use to estimate recharge, and those are generally water budget models. So it's similar to a water budget method, but you're using numerical models to estimate recharge. There are also methods based on surface water flow, surface water data measurements, looking at groundwater inputs to surface water, either through changes in discharge measured along a reach in the surface water, or other ways to look at groundwater discharge, such as changes in water quality, which I'll talk about in a minute. So you can use surface water discharge of groundwater to estimate the recharge, because in natural systems, typically recharge and discharge are similar, and there are not huge changes in storage. There are also physical methods. You can actually measure the changes in water content in the unsaturated zone using instruments like tensiometers. And in the saturated zone, you can actually look at groundwater level changes over time in response to precipitation events and get an estimate of changes in that storage, which will help you understand the recharge to the system. And then there's also tracer methods, such as chemical tracers like chloride, where you can look at the migration of chloride in the unsaturated zone to understand how water is infiltrating into the unsaturated zone and down to the water table. So characterizing surface water flows is generally done with discharge measurements, either manual measurements using a flow meter and channel cross sections, as there's a picture here of some people doing that at the Yanacocha mine in Peru, or when the flows are low, small flows, you can use a bucket and a stopwatch and estimate the discharge rate. Also, many mine sites have dedicated gauging stations. They might be installed by the mine or the USGS or state agencies, and those can have rating curves developed, which gives you a relationship between the water level in the stream and the discharge. What's really important is that you have sufficient data to understand the temporal nature of the flows and the long-term variability that you see in the surface water features around mines. Also need to characterize any groundwater surface water interactions that are in the area of the mine site. So you need to characterize gaining and losing reaches. And so where groundwater is discharging to a stream, where the stream is gaining, or if the stream is discharging to the groundwater, then that's a losing reach. And that can change seasonally, depending on what's going on with the banks and the groundwater flow gradients and the stream flows. You need to compare the stream discharge to different locations to get a sense of what groundwater inputs are along that particular reach. You can also look at the elevation changes between the stream and the groundwater to understand if there are gradients to or from the stream. You can also look at chemical methods to understand loading from groundwater, such as changes in water quality. If you understand the groundwater quality, understand the quality in the stream, you can look at changes in that water quality to understand how groundwater is loading contaminants or other constituents to the stream. So in this area, you need to really consider the amount and the reliability of measurements that you have to characterize those interactions, and whether you can understand them during baseline and pre-mining conditions, as well as the seasonality and any water quality changes you see over time. So developing a water budget for a mine site is really critical. You need to develop that pre-mining, during mining, and post-mining. And if you're in the permit phase, which I understand many people who are listening to this talk are, and reviewing mine permits, you will be looking at predictions of how the water balance will change during and after mining. So the water budget is essentially the inputs to the hydrologic system at the mine, minus the outputs, and any change of in storage that occurs over the life of the mine and post-closure. You can do this site-wide across the mine site and the catchment, or within individual mine facilities, such as waste rock facilities or tailings impoundments. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So this is an example of a water balance for the Straight Creek catchment in the Red River Valley in New Mexico. It's the Cuesta mine. And here, the purpose of this was to understand the hydrologic conditions in an analog catchment that was adjacent to the mine, because the mine had been operating for a long time, since the 20s, and they wanted to understand how the hydrology would have been in that mine area prior to mining. So they used a catchment adjacent to the mine. So in this case, you have precipitation estimated at 701 gallons per minute, and then evapotranspiration. And then, by the way, the precipitation was estimated based on stations that were collected at the mine, but also in adjacent areas that had longer meteorological data records, and then adjusted for the elevations at the mine. And then evapotranspiration turned out to be 77% of this water balance. Discharge to groundwater was 21.3%, and that was estimated using information on the hydraulic properties of the aquifer and estimating flow through the aquifer. And then runoff to surface water was less than 1%. So there was no change in storage in this system. In their assumptions, it was assumed to be a steady state system, and they based all this on an annual average for the mine. So it's just an example of how the precipitation is then equal to the evapotranspiration, the discharge to surface water, and the discharge to the groundwater. So characterizing the unsaturated zone properties, so this is the hydraulic properties of mine waste and covers and native ground. You need to characterize the unsaturated flow properties of those materials. So that includes porosity, you know, initial water content, permeability as a function of pressure head, negative pressure within the soils. And the various characterization methods include lab tests on mine waste and native materials to develop these kind of curves, soil water characteristic curve. Measurements in the field using instruments such as an infiltrometer to measure infiltration into soils. And one of the things to consider is that you may not be adequately characterizing the presence of macropores, which allow much more rapid infiltration into these materials, or internal layers within the unsaturated zone. This photo in the corner here is a picture of the upper soil horizon at the Yanacocha mine in Peru. This layer is referred to by the local campesinos who live around the mine as the sponge. And when we were evaluating the potential hydrologic impacts of the mine on the water quantity around the mine, we characterized this sponge layer, this A horizon layer, and it, as it turned out, it had a very high capacity to store water. So the campesinos were actually correct about its ability to store and transmit water, and that being an important feature of the native system at that in the area of that mine. And of course, that'll be changed when mine facilities are constructed. So characterizing the saturated zones, you're looking at the aquifers and aquitards that are present within the mine site and the area that will be affected by the mine. So the various geologic units that are present, the continuity of those aquifers, and both in the vertical and the lateral extent, and the presence of faults and fractures in the mine area. So various characterization methods include mapping of the geology on the surface, logging of boreholes, such as exploration boreholes, information from regional studies. The mine will be developing a block model of the geology as part of their understanding of the deposit and development of the mine plan. So there's a mine block model that also can be used to glean information. And then observations of aquifer response during pumping, either testing or dewatering types of pumping, or for processed water. So the hydraulic properties of the aquifer and aquitards include characterizing hydraulic conductivity, saturated thickness, storage coefficients, and whether the unit is confined or unconfined. The methods that are used for determining hydraulic conductivity, and I've put them in sort of order of decreasing reliability, are pumping tests where you pump on a well and you either observe the change in water level, the response at that well, or at observation wells that are located some distance from the pumping well. If you have both a pumping well and observation wells, you can get information on storage of the aquifer between those units. If you just have a single well pumping test, you can't get storage information, but you can get hydraulic conductivity information. So the best kind of test is a pumping test where you're pumping one well and looking at responses in multiple observation wells, because you are getting good sense of representation of the hydraulic properties between the pumping well and the observation well. Also another common test are slug tests, where you add a slug or remove a slug of either water or a actual hard material, that's an actual slug, from a well, and you look at the response at the water levels in that well. And this test is not as reliable as a pumping test because you're only testing a small distance around the well, because you're only removing a small amount of water. There's also laboratory permeability tests, where you actually measure the permeability of the material in the lab. That's usually a very small sample and is not going to be as representative as of the bulk aquifer properties. And then the least reliable is literature values for similar geologic material, so because that's not site specific. Hydraulic connectivity has issues because the values can range over 10, 11 orders of magnitude. And you need to capture that heterogeneity to understand groundwater flow and contaminant transport pathways. So one of the things to consider is, do you have hydraulic connectivity data for the significant aquifers and geologic units in the mine area? And for unconfined and confined units. So in other words, unconfined being the ones closer to the surface, a water table aquifer, and confined units would be deeper in the ground with a confining unit over them. And then another question is, are the data grouped in space? Do you have good spatial representation, or is all of your hydraulic testing in one portion of the mine site and in one aquifer system? And then the question of whether the flow is channelized into higher permeability zones, fractures, or conduits is really important to consider as well. So most often people assume that groundwater flow is in a porous media type flow path, which is intergranular flow. It's groundwater is flowing between grains, such as in sands, unconsolidated deposits like a sand or a gravel, or a rock like a sandstone. Typically, at most hard rock mine sites, the flow paths are in fractured rock, especially in the deposit area. You may have more porous media type of flow in areas where you have, you're out in valley floors, where you have alluvium, you have tailings impoundments. That may be more of a porous media situation, but you often, at hard rock mines, have flow in fractured rocks, such as slate or granite or gneiss. And the pathways are these fractures and those features in the rock. So in fractured rock, flow is dependent on the fracture connectivity and spacing and aperture, how open it is, and the density of the fractures. And these data are typically limited or absent at many sites. So often what people do is they assume equivalent porous media. They assume it's the same as intergranular flow. But the problem with that is that fractured systems may be very anisotropic. In other words, you may have very strong flow in one direction and not in another direction. And you may have all of your flow occurring on these fractures that are hard to characterize and understand and then predict the flow and the contaminant migration. So here's a picture of a real-world fracture, which is very uneven and has variable aperture, and sort of what you idealize a fracture to look like if you're trying to do any kind of calculations or modeling of fractures. They're typically idealized as a plane. So this is a big challenge at mine sites because it's crucial to understand these fracture flow paths, and yet they're very difficult to characterize. So one thing that people do is that they map the fractures on the surface, so surface mapping, geologic mapping, and within boreholes, looking at rock quality data to understand the fracturing. There are also downhole testing methods that people can use at mine sites. There's geophysical logging, there's flow meters that can go down boreholes, and also video. Those are, somewhat expensive techniques. There's also tracers and isotopes that can be used, and Mike Wireman in the next lecture is going to talk about those methods and how they can be used to characterize pathways at fractured rock sites. This is an example of why it's really important to understand and characterize fractures. This is from the Avtex Fiber Superfund site in Virginia. It's not a mine site, but it is a site where wastes were disposed. If I can grab this. Wastes were disposed in three basins here. This is waste from the manufacturer of rayon. And this is in a fractured environment of slates and shale. And the gradients that you would map in sort of a traditional method using elevations in the boreholes would indicate that the flow from these waste facilities would be towards this gray line here, which is the Shenandoah River. So that's what you would expect if you were just kind of following this idea that this might behave as a porous media and groundwater would flow towards the river and discharge to its river, as it often does. At this site, this is where this is the groundwater plume of carbon disulfide that emanates from these waste basins, and which were actually excavated to the bedrock surface. So they're basically lying right on fractured bedrock. And the plume migrated underneath the Shenandoah River and impacted wells on this side of the Shenandoah River. It also migrated in this direction rather than directly towards the river, as you might have anticipated. And the reason for that is that this is in the Valley and Ridge Province in Virginia, and the geology is characterized by a series of very tight anticlines and synclines and thrust faults. So you have fold axes and faulting in this direction in a southwest to northeast direction. And you can see here's the surface trace of two of the thrust faults and a fold axis mapped here. And here is where the basins are. So the plume migrated along fractures, preferential fractures, along this direction in the southwest to northeast direction. We conducted a pumping test right here. We had a pumping well, and we monitored the response of the aquifer in observation wells all around this pumping well. And you can see that the response is highly anisotropic in that you have much more drawdown along the direction of the folds and the fractures, and far less in the direction that's perpendicular to these fractures. So this provides a real good understanding of why the plume migrated in the way that it did. And if you were coming into this situation without this sort of tracer, this inadvertent tracer of the plume that emanated out of these basins, you might not guess that the plume would move in this way unless you really understood the nature of the fractures and how they're oriented at this site. So there are a lot of sources of uncertainty in hydrologic characterization. There's large natural variability in hydrologic and geochemical conditions. There's sort of the inability to sample all the material and to make inferences from a limited number of tests of maybe characterizing unsaturated zone or aquifer properties. You may have to measure points in a lab, which may not measure, be representative of field scale processes. And then there's a lot of hydrogeologic complexity, particularly fractures. And then finally, in a changing climate, when you're extrapolating to the future with some of these mine sites that may be operational for 30 years or longer, changing climatic conditions can really affect the assumptions that you're making about the water balance and the flow path in the future. So I'd also like to talk a bit about the influence of mine facilities on hydrologic processes and contaminant pathways. So it's really important to understand the effects of the facilities, dewatering operations, other mine operations, and mine water management on water quantity and quality at these mines. It's important for having effective mitigation measures, such as effective cover designs, and also to design the mine facilities such as tailings dams, stormwater, other diversions, stormwater retention ponds, and culverts. So construction of mine facilities can change and will change near surface processes such as evapotranspiration rates, runoff, and recharge rates. They can interrupt or change recharge rates because you're constructing these facilities. They're large facilities, and you're constructing them over large areas of the drainage basin. You can have changes in recharge because you can have infiltrating wetting fronts through waste rock, which can discharge or load to groundwater. Similarly with online tailings impoundments, you can discharge and loading to groundwater from those impoundments. And then also creation of ponds and pit lakes increase evaporative losses at the mine. So all these things affect these near-surface processes. They also change groundwater and surface water flow. Dewatering of pits and underground mines have an influence on spring and stream flows. Flooding of underground workings provides conduits for flow and transport. Discharge of treated mine water, moving water from one basin to another, has an influence on the surface water flows and quality in those surface water features. And then creating pit lakes and impoundments alters the groundwater flow patterns and pathways around those facilities. So waste rock hydrology. Waste rock is generally deposited with a lower initial moisture content because when it's blasted from the mine site and then deposited, it has a higher porosity and less water within that unit in the pores because there's more porosity. Then as infiltration from snow and rain infiltrates into the waste rock pile, you develop a wetting front that migrates through the surface of the dump. It can also migrate laterally if there are lifts and other structures within the waste rock pile that affect the flow. And in arid environments, this migration of a wetting front can take, you know, tens to hundreds of years. It's a delayed impact. And in, of course, humid environments, that can be very rapid. You can also have discharge from seeps at the toes of the waste rock facilities because it's a much smaller or shorter migration pathway for fluids from the toes of the waste rock facilities here. And covers that are designed for waste rock are typically designed to increase evapotranspiration or decrease infiltration into the waste rock. So here's a diagram showing the hydrology of a waste rock facility. And you can see the wetting front migrating through the waste rock at time one and then time two as the waste rock wets up. You have a veto zone. Oh, I should grab this. I'm using the wrong cursor. So you have migration through the waste rock, and then you have migration from the waste rock facility down through the veto zone, and then potentially loading of materials to the groundwater below. You also can have, in some situations, the groundwater flow may be very close to the surface, and fluctuations of groundwater may cause the groundwater to actually intersect the waste rock itself. And here is a monitoring well down gradient of this waste rock facility to monitor for changes in contaminants. Heap leach is similar to a waste rock, with the exception that additional fluids are added to the leach. So usually acid to leach the metals from the heap leach. And these are typically lined, so I've drawn a liner here. And so you, unless there's leakage through the liner, you generally do not have impacts to groundwater. Although, again, groundwater flow can also move up into, groundwater table can move up into the heap leach facilities and actually interact with the heap leach. Tailings impoundments, the hydrology of those. The slurry that is sent out to the impoundments generally contains fines with very high water content, you know, 60 to 80% water. There are often fluctuating water levels within the impoundment, and at the surface, that can cause oxidation of any sulfides remaining in the tailings materials and possibly generation of acid drainage. During mining or even post-closure, a water cover can be maintained on that impoundment, which would change the evaporative losses. Unlined tailings impoundments drain slowly to groundwater through the veto zone, and covers on impoundments are also typically designed to increase evapotranspiration or decrease infiltration. It's a picture of tailings impoundments at the Betsy Pit in Nevada, and you can see this, but this is just some heterogeneity within the tailings layers where you can see finer and coarser material within the tailings. Here's a diagram of the hydrology of an impoundment. You have saturated tailings here. You have unsaturated tailings if the water is allowed to drain down below the surface of the tailings. You have a pond here for recovering. Typically, the water is recovered there and sent back into the process system. You can have percolation from the pore water of the tailings down through the veda zone, and then migration with the groundwater flow in the direction of the groundwater gradient. So dewatering and flooding of open pits, clearly during mining, when you are dewatering these pits, that lowers the water table, creates a cone of depression, and can affect springs and streams in the area of the mine. Post-mining, if a lake is allowed to form in the open pit, the pit could either be an evaporative sink where groundwater is in towards the pit lake at all times, or it can be a through-flow pit where you have flow from one side of the pit and discharge out another side of the pit lake. And then pit backfill, backfilling a pit with waste rock, for example, can alter the hydrology and the contaminant pathways as well. So I just have some diagrams to show that. This is during dewatering, and you have some dewatering wells that are lowering the regional water table and creating a cone of depression around the open pit. And this alters, obviously, the hydrologic flow paths around the pit. Then after mining, when the lake is allowed to form, this is an example of an inflow to a pit. This pit would be an evaporative sink where groundwater would flow into the lake, and then evaporation from the surface of the lake would cause there to always to be an inward gradient into the pit lake. Another case of a through-flow pit lake where you have groundwater coming in from the left side here, flowing through the lake and discharging from the lake to the regional groundwater system. Obviously, the change from if you have an inward flowing lake, your issues generally relate to concentrations of contaminants within that pit lake and whether those form a ecological risk. If you have a through-flow lake, then you need to be concerned about groundwater impacts down gradient of the lake, because your water from your lake will move into your regional groundwater, potentially contaminating it. And then backfilling a lake or a pit with waste rock or other material causes there not to be a lake, but you still have groundwater flow through the open pit, through the waste rock material, and then discharge down gradient the lake. So you have a potential impact to groundwater from through flow through that pit. I wanted to mention that changes in the mine plan often result in changes in hydrologic conditions. So often a mine is permitted with a particular mine plan, and then as as the situation changes, metals prices change, the facilities might expand, the mine open pit may expand, and so you need to be reevaluating the changes in the hydrologic conditions and the characterization of those as the mine plan changes and as mining proceeds. As mining proceeds, you do get increased hydrologic information. For example, actual dewatering of a pit is a much larger scale pumping test than the kind of pumping tests that are often done to characterize the mine as sort of pre-mining, which might be maybe a 48-hour pumping test. Once you start actually dewatering, you will get more information about how pumping at the mine is influencing the groundwater flow, and probably a lot more information about fracture flow and pathways. So that's also a really important thing to consider, is that you'll be increasing your hydrologic data and characterization as the mining proceeds. So in summary, to summarize this and to lead into Mike's talk on contaminant transport, sort of baseline pre-mining early on in the permit process, you're characterizing the natural hydrologic system, so you need a very good understanding of the water balance. You want to make sure that you're capturing all the natural variability in precipitation and evapotranspiration, runoff, infiltration, site-wide and within in the future within mine facilities. Mine sites are really complex flow systems, especially because of the fractured rock environment. And Mike will talk about methods for characterizing fractured rock at these sites in some real live case examples. Then with the mine altered hydrologic system, you know, there will be changes in the recharge, discharge, and flow paths caused by the facilities and by the mine water management. And that also potentially loading of contaminants that will change groundwater and surface water quality in the region of the mine. So it's important to continue to reevaluate your characterization of your hydrologic processes as additional data become available and as the mine plan changes and mining and proceeds. So that is the end of my talk. I'd be happy to take any questions if we have a couple minutes, or maybe am I out of time?
No, Connie, you did perfect. Yes, we got a number of questions that have come in while you were speaking, so I think we could take a few minutes here to answer some of them. The first question that came in, this person wants to know how you measure flows using the bucket and stopwatch method.
Oh, so that's a really simple method, and you know, used at sort of remote sites where you don't have a dedicated gauging station, and you need to have a small flow. So you basically fill the bucket and time how long it takes to fill the bucket. Say you have a 5-gallon bucket, you fill it up with the flow in the stream, and then measure how long it took you to fill it. So then you get an estimate of how many gallons per minute or whatever unit you want to use and convert that, the flow is in that system. Obviously, you need a very small flow.
Right. Great. Then we got a question. Someone wanted some clarification on your Cuesta example. They wanted to know how you arrived at gallons per minute for precipitation.
Okay, so that study was done by Makeda and Naus, and it was, so it's a USGS study, so I actually didn't do that study, I was just using it as an example. My understanding of what they did was they had some data from meteorological data, precipitation data from the mine area, but there wasn't a great deal of data. It was only maybe a couple years of record. So they used a meteorological station that was off the mine site, and they then correlated precipitation events at the mine site with the meteorological station that was off the mine site, and also accounted for the differences in elevation between those sites. So it was sort of a correlation exercise. And then they estimated that precipitation over the catchment, Great Creek catchment, and added that together to come up with the estimate of 701 gallons per minute. I should also mention that they did do a sensitivity analysis on their estimates. And, you know, you can download this study if you want. It's, if you just Google Makeda Naus 2008, you'd be able to get this study. It's a nice study of a water balance in a natural catchment near a mine site.
Great. I have a couple more questions here I think that we can get to. This person wants to know if you can provide a minimum or a rule of thumb for how many seasons or years to collect precipitation for mine sites. And I guess the reason they're asking this is they're stating that proposed mines don't always have, you know, more than a couple or a few years of data.
Yeah, and that is an excellent point and often a challenge because a lot of these sites are pretty remote. So the mine will, you know, mine proponent who's interested in the mine will often set up a meteorological station. But, you know, when you go into the permitting process, you might only have, you know, 2 or 3 years of data, maybe at a couple meteorological stations. So, you know, as with most of these, you know, characterization of environmental processes, there's no bright line about how many years of data you need. I would say that if there are meteorological stations that are in the area of the mine site but not on the mine site, looking at the variability, if you have a longer-term record in those locations, looking at the variability that you see in that precipitation record can help you understand you know, how much variability you might see at the mine site. And you can also do correlations, you know, depending on how far away the meteorological station is that has a longer-term record. You can correlate those with the years of data that you have at the mine to help you understand that variability. But it's a real challenge in permitting because, you know, you really need a handle of how much water you're going to need to be managing. It affects design of the mine facilities. It affects dewatering projections. It affects facility design. And so it's really important to know that, and yet we often are in a situation where we don't have a lot of precipitation data. You might not even have characterized, you know, a wet and a dry and kind of an average year, and you don't really have a framework for knowing if you've really characterized a wet, dry, and an average year to look at sort of at least some bounds on what you might see at the site.
Okay, great. And I guess somewhat related, so how would you account for snowfall and snowpack contributions to the annual precipitation?
Well, the you know, the gauges will measure snowfall. They're not always great at doing that, especially in places where there's a lot of wind. But snowpack is a storage term within sort of the water balance. So when you're looking at precipitation, there is a sort of a delay or a storage of that precipitation in the snowpack until the spring melt and runoff. And so you need to account for, if you're looking at an annual water budget, then you wouldn't necessarily need to worry as much about the storage time. But if you're looking at the water budget over seasons, you're going to have water removed from the system because it's stored in that snowpack and then released to the system in the spring. And that's important to consider in your water balance, looking at the seasonality of that. I hope I answered
the great
question.
Yeah. I think maybe we'll take one more question. And then in the meantime, Gene, can you bring up Mike's presentation so we can get him ready to go?
Absolutely.
Great. So this participant wants to know what data you use to estimate evapotranspiration.
Well, there are... There are many methods. I'm just laughing at Mike, who was saying you grab it out of the air. There are many, you know, methods for estimating evapotranspiration, and they use different kinds of meteorological data. There are sort of simple methods, like the Thornthwaite method that uses, I believe, precipitation and air temperature, and not much more to estimate evapotranspiration. There are other equations that have been developed using other meteorological parameters to estimate that. So it's, you know, there are a variety of methods, and some might be more appropriate to certain situations, depending on whether, you know, you're concerned about something like snowpack, which may not be well handled with some of these methods. Because they're not considering those processes. So there are a whole lot of different formulas that you can use.
Great. Well, thanks, Connie. Hopefully we'll have time at the end of the next two presentations for some more questions and discussion. So Mike Wireman is our next presenter, and he's actually in the same room with Connie, and you'll see that he's just joined us on the video. Mike Wireman is a hydrogeologist with the EPA in Denver, Colorado. He has 25 years of experience in groundwater investigations in the Rocky Mountain West. Mike provides technical and scientific support to several EPA programs, other federal agencies, international programs, and groundwater protection and management programs in several western states. So we're very excited to have Mike. He's going to talk to us about some fate and transport of contaminants from mine-related facilities. So. If you're ready, Mike, you're good to
go. I'm ready.
Great.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody, and thanks for taking the time to participate in this webinar series, and thanks to EPA Region 9 for setting this up. I'm going to follow on what Connie talked about in her just-finished slideshow, and I'm going to focus a little bit on groundwater and on fractured rock settings because, as Connie indicated, most precious metal and heavy metal mines occur in fractured rock settings, certainly not all, but most of them around the world in mountain ranges. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about some characterization tools that we've developed over the past 10 years to try and better understand the hydrology of these mining districts at a watershed or sort of sub-watershed scale. There we go. So the focus of my talk here over the next 30, 35 minutes, I'm going to focus a lot on this environmental characterization because we spend a lot of time trying to understand the hydrology, as I said, of sort of watershed or sub-watershed scale. And then that data and information and those understandings are very useful for a variety of programs, including NEPA program and looking at EISs, including permitting responsibilities associated with mines. So the conceptual hydrogeologic model, I'll talk about that and show you a couple of those for fractured rock settings. It's very important to try and develop a conceptual model from the very beginning so that you can put all the data and what you learn over time into that model and continue to evolve that model to a point where you're kind of comfortable with understanding how water flows through these systems. Geologic controls are huge, particularly with respect to fractured rock settings because we don't have Darcy flow here, really. And then geochemical controls relate to the chemistry of the water and the chemistry of the waste fluids that emanate from mine sites. I'm going to focus. I don't have time to go through all these tools. I put a list here that's a bit long just to show you what's out there. I'm going to go through the ones that are in red here and give you some examples and some case studies there. I do want to mention, I know Kirk probably talked a little bit about geochemical modeling in the first workshop. It's very helpful. I'm not going to spend a lot of time there. I do want to mention EMMA, though, which stands for end-member mixing analysis. And I don't have time to go into that in detail, but I just want to mention it because it is a tool that allows you to sort of make a very educated guess about a source of water to a particular facility, whether it would be groundwater flowing or water flowing into underground workings, into a pit, whatever. If you have a sufficient amount of just chemistry data, and that's the importance and sort of the value of EMMA, if you have a powerful data set of chemistry data from the point of interest and from the potential sources of water, you can actually identify the most important or primary sources of water to a particular facility. It's very data intensive, it's very computer intensive, and isn't used very often, though it's powerful when you have enough data. I want to just mention, you know, a lot of folks on here are involved on the upfront side of mines, looking either at EISs as reviewers or looking at some aspect of the permitting process for a hard rock mine, which we all know takes, you know, 5 to 10 years to get permits out. But at EPA and the USGS, we have been able to go into a number of surplus sites, of listed sites around the country that are legacy sites in large respect, not all of them. But we, in the course of conducting remedial investigations and feasibility studies for remedies, we've actually done a lot of applied science in these locations, and we've learned a lot. We've developed tools for characterizing the hydrology and then using that information, those understandings, feedback into the upfront end of these mining sites so that we have some continuing, evolving understanding of the hydrology in these watersheds and how it all works. So I just want to point that out, that those two, you wouldn't really think of CERCLA and NEPA being connected, but they are in this sense. As Connie mentioned, there are numerous sources of heavy metals or metals in general and acid at hard rock mine sites, and I've just a reminder, I'm not going to talk about this. She did a great job of talking about the sort of hydrology of individual facilities, but there are many types of facilities that can release metals and acid in the form of wastewaters. And metals and acid are transported away from major mine-related sources. This is pretty simple, via runoff, snow and rain, though that, as you bear down on that, that's not quite so simple. Groundwater flow and then interflow, which I'll explain and talk about a little bit, the mountain catchments that are snowmelt dominated. Interflow is a very important seasonal process. And then, of course, stream flow and air. So we've got multiple ways you can remove these metals, take them out into the environment, away from the permitted area of the mine, and have potential impacts to other water resources. So a little bit about conceptual model, and again, this is fractured rock settings, and even more specific, it's aimed at mountain catchments. And mountain catchments have relief, and relief is an important thing to understand here, because if we all go back to Darcy's Law, KIA, everybody ignores the I because it's typically very low. But in these environments, the I is very high. And so the amount of flow or the amount of water that can flow along a pathway is directly related to the I. You double the I, you double the flow. So that's something to keep in mind that we often forget. These mountain catchments that are underlain by fractured rocks, typically igneous metamorphic rocks, sometimes fractured sedimentary rocks, there's some commonalities that we've learned. They're typically gaining streams in the upper reaches of these catchments. As you get out into the flatlands away from the relief, you can have losing stretches. And these are not absolute, but you ought to go in thinking this. There often is a very strong upper grading in a valley bottom. And Connie talked about leach facilities and tailings impoundments. And one of the reasons we strongly encourage lining of those things is because I have seen the hydraulic pressure from upward moving groundwater actually cause liners to fail. So we need to keep that in mind. The stream is the lowest hydraulic pressure point in the whole catchment. And that's where all the water's trying to get to. And it finds a complicated way to get there, but that's where it's headed. There are many seeps and springs in these catchments, which it tells you a couple things. There are multiple scale flow systems. You have groundwater flow where the distance between recharge and discharge is very short. Residence time is short. You have other sort of scales where it's much longer, so you need to keep that in mind. It's typically not one nice, smooth flow system. The springs and seeps, and I'll just give you a reminder, they're very good as monitoring points, both pre-mining, and during mining, and post-mining. Springs are groundwater discharge points, and so they can tell you something about transport of contaminants. Interflow, and I'll point that out in a couple of slides in terms of what that is and why it's important. It's important to keep in mind that we often have highly preferential groundwater flow along selected pathways. The bulk porosity of these rocks and the bulk permeability is usually pretty low. But along preferential flow paths and areas, it can be very high. And so that variability, and Connie talked about that, it's really important. There's a lot of variability in terms of the hydrologic parameters. Again, high relief. So you can get quite rapid groundwater flow along certain pathways. Significant seasonal variation in flow and water level, and this often is a result of snowmelt-dominated catchment, but it's also a result of fractured flow. I have seen, for instance, in the New World Mining District in Cook City, Montana, we've had monitoring wells in known faults, and water levels can fluctuate 80 to 100 feet naturally over the course of a year. It tells you something about the limited porosity, but that has to be factored in. And then obviously the chemistry of the groundwater and surface water can be very much influenced by the mineralogy of the ore body at a sort of quasi-watershed scale. These are often bigger ore bodies. Mountain catchments can be big. They can also be small. So just to sort of set the stage for some of the conceptual understandings. Groundwater has a huge role when it comes to precious metals and heavy metals and all metals. It sort of is the way minerals get deposited by hydrothermal fluids. It's a very common way to move those metals via hydrothermal fluids into rock environments and then precipitate them out or deposit them in some way. The water takes part in all the redox reactions, is the transport media as well, plays a part in the hydrothermal alteration, and So it's a fundamental in terms of metal deposition. Natural concentrations, however, tend to be pretty low of metals in groundwater due to a variety of things. They're not highly soluble compared to many other things. They're readily adsorbed. They're positive, they're cations, so they're easily exchanged for other cations of the same size. And then they like to complex in hydrolysis with other species. So there's a lot of ways metals can come out of solution and go somewhere else, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. Oops. Okay, first, just a word about the way, the types of deposits that we have. It's important to know what you have. Do you have vein deposits? Do you have disseminated deposits, low-grade disseminated deposits? Do you have replacement deposits? What we see being mined now in large parts of the world are disseminated deposits because the vein deposits were relatively high-grade, and they've been mined. So we see a move towards mining quite low ore content, but massive volumes of the ore body. So there's money to be made there, and that's why leaching has now become sort of more popular as time goes on, because that's a preferred way to get metals out of these low-grade deposits. So it's important to know what you have in terms of what the types of deposits are as you go into this. Geology, as Connie said, is critically important. You really have to know a little bit about the geology because it not only hosts the ore, it moves the water. I've got two examples here, and let's see if I can move this. Is this a right click or left click? Right in here, this is the Creede Mining District, the largest silver mining district in all of Colorado. And the ore occurs almost exclusively in gravenpols. And there are a couple of them here, one here, and then one here. And then intragraben in this area in the middle, it's been highly fractured, and I don't have time for all the explanation, but when you have an intragraben area, there's a certain fracture network that one expects. And in these volcanic tufts, it really is the only porosity and permeability other than the faults themselves. And so you have to kind of understand that. We're looking at this site and trying to really figure out the source of water into a set of underground workings that then discharges out of an abandoned tunnel. And so it's very, very different than a situation like the bottom one here, which is Rico down in southwest Colorado. Both of these are San Juan Mountains. But this one has sedimentary rocks that are sort of igneous rocks have been intruded into the sedimentary rocks, and the igneous rocks brought the ore body. But the sedimentary rocks are limestones and carbonates, and they do a couple of things. They're incredible aquifers. They hold and move a lot of water. They also provide some buffering in terms of pH. So very different hydrogeologic environments here. A lot more water down here to deal with. It turns out the ore body was also in the limestone, so you've got replacement deposits in the limestone of these fluids coming along the igneous rocks going into the limestone. And then those limestones are also the aquifer. So in this case, we had an enormous amount of fresh groundwater coming into a tunnel that was contaminated by a very small amount of mineralized material, so which is not an uncommon case. Groundwater's not contaminated, becomes contaminated once it flows into the workings and then comes out as contaminated water. So understanding the geology is critical. What are the sort of types of preferential paths? I talk about preferential groundwater flow. That occurs primarily in these discontinuities and fractured rocks, and these are the primary types. I think from what I've seen over the years, faults and shear zones are very important in terms of moving water. There's an old sort of school of thought that all faults are boundaries, that they're impermeable because they're gouged up. Well, that's simply not the case. Where you have young faults, Laramide age, many of those or portions of those tend to be not gouged. They can be quite wide, and they can move an enormous amount of water. So they become very important, and kind of gave you a really good example of that a little bit, and there are many examples of that. So knowing where they are and how they serve as a boundary. No flow across them. Sometimes the faults will simply divert water at 90 degrees. Groundwater intercepts the fault, makes a right turn, in the downgrading direction and flows in the fault. We've seen that happen. Fractures, if they're dense enough, can result in volumes of rock having high permeability and high porosity from these dense fractures. But they're not faults. There's been no displacement, just fractures creating porosity. And then zones of chemically altered rock. That's an interesting thing. There's a mine down in southwest Colorado, the Carbonero mine. It discharges up to 2,000 gallons a minute, from about 700 to 2,000 gallons a minute, depending on the season of the year. But the discharge happens at 12,800 feet above sea level. And you wonder, how can you get that much discharge out of, there isn't much watershed above this. And the answer is, this is a volcanic conglomerate that post-deposition got hydrothermal fluid movement through it and altered large volumes of this rock. Didn't fracture it, didn't displace it, just altered it and created weak rock that then became porous. And so this is a large, high snowmelt area, gets huge recharge every year, and the mine working simply poked into that volume of rock. Bad luck on their part. And then as I indicated on the RICO example, you often have carbonate formations. Interbedded is not a good term because these are igneous intrusives that come in. But on a cross-section, it looks like carbonate, igneous. And so the boundaries there are important. Carbonate formations themselves are important in terms of the obstacles. Connie had this slide. I just want to point this out again. The fractured rock. Let me just up here. The fractured rock environment, extremely different than the nice, ideal Darcy flow, porous media flow. It's highly constrained in fractured rocks, and the mathematical formulas for transmissivity, hydraulic conductivity really relate, as Connie said, to the aperture of these fractures. And so what that means is water table maps are not very useful in these environments. They just aren't. And again, she gave you a great example of that. You just can't accept those. You have to know more about the preferential flow paths and then focus in on those. This is a fault trace up near the Kohler Tunnel down in southwest Colorado. And you can see evidence of recent discharge from this fault zone here. So this flows a portion of the year, not all year, but a portion of the year, and becomes a good monitoring location. This is an example of what happens to water level contours, to potentiometric surface contours as you flow through these fractured rocks. And you can see you don't have nice, smooth contour lines. They're bent, they're perturbed, and it all has to do with the very great differences in permeability between one of these units and the other units. And so these interbedded, in this case, these are basalts up in the Columbia River, with some very permeable layers separated by some very low permeability layers. And so water table maps and contour maps, just be very careful of those in terms of how they're constructed and how they're interpreted. This is an example of a cartoon that I put together to kind of give us some ideas about conceptualized groundwater flow and fractured rocks. And this is at an existing mining site, so there ends up being sort of three types of flow systems I want to show you about here. The first one just has to do with the mine itself, the stopes, the underground workings, the tunnels. Those, as Connie said, highly perturb the regional system, and so they can be a sink. Sometimes they're not, but they highly perturb it, and the water that's intercepted by these workings is taken out of the rest of the system. So you have to deal with that. Then there's a shallow, this, let me get this going here. This right here, in granitic rocks in particular, and Pike's Peak is the best example of this I've ever seen. You have this layer that's called grus, G-R-U-S. And what it is, it's residual granite that is highly, highly chemically weathered to the point where it's an in-place gravel. It's still the granite, there's been no faulting, there's been no movement. It's just weathered so extremely, and it can be 50 to 60 feet thick, and so you've got essentially a pile of gravel sitting on top of this solid granite. So that becomes a separate flow system, and when I talk about interflow, you'll see the importance of that. That holds water, discharges water, people put wells in it. And then you have a third system, which is really the more dominant regional system, where all these structures, whether they be fractures or joints or altered areas. The groundwater here kind of flows down these things, and I'll show you some results later of this site. Connie's example, you had groundwater flowing along strike of a fault. In, where you have high relief, the strike of the structures is not necessarily where the water is going to flow. It will as long as it's in that structure, and I'll talk more about that later. Another example, this is Jefferson County, Colorado, west of Denver. And what I want to point out in this slide is this concept of interflow right here. Let me get my arrow. Interflow occurs because you have a lot of snowmelt in this catchment, and evapotranspiration takes an enormous amount of that. But a very small amount, and I really appreciated Connie's example because it fit with what I've understood, a very small amount of it runs off to the street, very small. Most of it either goes up or infiltrates. And of the portion that infiltrates, once you saturate this unsaturated zone, which extends from here up to here, as you saturate that by delivering an enormous amount of snowmelt over a 6 or 8 week period in the summer, you fully saturate the upper portion of this unsaturated zone. So interflow can almost be thought of as saturated flow in the unsaturated zone, because as you saturate it, you cannot have horizontal ground flow or groundwater flow if you don't have saturated conditions. If it's unsaturated, the movement is vertical. So as you saturate this from the top, you then induce horizontal flow to the river and to the creek. So interflow over a very short period of time on an annual basis can deliver a big portion of the water budget to that stream. And you have to know that, because it's not getting to the groundwater. Some of it is, but a lot of it in these fractured rock environments simply runs off as interflow through the regolith or the grues layer directly to the stream. And that's a transient thing, but it can involve a large amount of water. Okay, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these because I know Ann and Kirk talked about these. I just want to remind you that there's a lot of geochemical processes in addition to the geologic things that can control the species of metal that you see, the concentration and distribution of these metals. Redox reactions are absolutely critical because metals want to be oxidized, not reduced. They're very, very, they just like to be oxidized because of the outer shell of electrons there in the metal atoms. These redox reactions, which are what causes acid, they're catalyzed by both water, which is the biggest, but they're also catalyzed by microorganisms, which are much more dominant than you would think. Other things that go on, I mentioned these before, metals are very subject to cation exchange and absorption and hydrolysis. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these. I want to spend the rest of my time on the characterization. But let me just remind you about one thing about acid generation. We all see the formula pyrite, which is a very common sulfide mineral associated with precious metal and heavy metal deposits. You interact that with oxygen and water, and you generate, in this case, ferrous iron, sulfate, and acid. And what I want to point out here is this is a feedback. As you create ferrous iron, it then reacts with the oxygen and the acid that was created here to generate ferric iron. And then ferric iron is a catalyst of oxidation. So if you have a lot of iron 3 in your water, you're going to have an increased rate of oxidation and acid generation. So one thing I always recommend is get some data on the iron speciation. Iron is a big driver in these systems where there is iron. Not all ore bodies have a lot of iron. Many do. So understanding the speciation of iron can help you understand the amount of oxidation that might go on, how long it might go on, and that can be important. And these types of pH-EH diagrams are out there for every metal. It tells you, what species of iron in this case to expect under certain pH-EH conditions. EH is kind of a field measurement of redox. And if you have negative numbers here, you're in a reducing environment. If you have positive numbers, you're in an oxidizing environment. And so you can find these diagrams for zinc, for all the metals of concern. And then one final thing to mention here is Faircrete. If you go into a new district or an old district with a new mine, ask the question, are there Faircrete deposits there? Because Faircrete is an indication of previous natural low pH conditions, that where there was discharge of acidic water naturally, and then the creation or the deposition of this incredibly hard, dense iron mineral called Faircrete. So ask that question. Okay, I'm going to finish up with these, going through four or five tools, show you some examples. Mainly these are focused on understanding flow paths and sources of water, which gets to the hydrology of the watershed or sub-watershed system that you're interested in. I'll talk about, this is pretty basic, but people tend to forget it. Water level measurements can be very valuable. I said there are constraints of water table maps, but it doesn't mean there are constraints of water level measurements. Chemistry and mass loading is important to look at the distribution, potential distribution of metals. I'll talk about water and stable water and radioactive isotopes and then trace it. One important point, always sample over the full hydrograph. Don't let people get away with sampling three quarters of the season, because we've talked about variability and it's huge and you'll miss it if you don't sample over a full hydrograph. This will be hard because many of these mining districts are in the mountains. Wintertime is tough, but you've got to push through on that. Mm-hmm. So water levels, just a couple examples of how important this is. This is Leadville, Colorado. This is the Leadville Mine Drain Tunnel. Let me get this up here. Right here. It's about 5 to 6 miles long. Discharges 1,500 gallons a minute year-round. It's a major problem because it exceeds standards in zinc. And just by constructing this region, this is a 30-square-mile area here in this slide, and constructing this potentiometric surface map tells us one thing. This tunnel is at absolutely right angles to the direction of flow. You couldn't have put a better French drain in this system if you had tried. So they didn't know that. This was to be a haul tunnel for ores back in the back in this part of the district here. But they put it and aligned it in a way that this is all carbonate bedrock groundwater. These are replacement deposits here in Leadville. And so they just constructed this tunnel in the most perfect way to intercept the most amount of water possible. And now they have to deal with it. So just a lesson there. This could have been maybe avoided. Of course, this was done in the 50s. It probably didn't really care too much. But anyway. And then here I've plotted the discharge of this tunnel right here with a water level in a shaft in the back here that goes down into the bedrock, into the ore body, and is essentially a monitoring well. All the water in that shaft is groundwater. We know that, bedrock groundwater. And you can see how the two compare quite well, which tells you, amongst many other things we have, that the discharge coming out of this tunnel is about 90% groundwater, with one exception here where in the spring snowmelt, we get a little inflow into the tunnel down here that causes that portal discharge to go up, and the bedrock groundwater hasn't responded yet. It's too early. So these types of simple plots could be very helpful in terms of understanding the interaction between groundwater flow systems and various mine facilities. Another example, this is French Gulch, and this is a mine tool. Let me get this up here. This is an abandoned mine, but many levels in this mine. It was stope and drift mine. And then here's a fault that comes all the way up here. And what happens is every year, the snowmelt and the recharge fills up the mine pool that resides in these workings. And the head on that mine pool drives water up this fault into French Creek. And the French Creek has a valley fill, unconsolidated deposit that is clearly Darcy flow, that normally goes towards the creek as we see, as we see here. But in the spring and summer, when this mine pool increases and drives more water up out of the fault here, we see an entirely different direction of flow for the groundwater in the valley fill material. So we've kind of indicated this variability is important. And if you don't have the right monitoring program and the right frequency of monitoring, you'll totally miss it. So just an example of how that works. Flow-weighted mass loading is really simple. And in concept, a little more difficult to practice, but basically you're looking at the discharge along a creek, the flow, and here we had an input of a tributary, so it jumps up. And then you look at the concentrations, in this case of zinc, as you go downstream. This is the same on the Chalk Creek down in the central Colorado Mountains. And the concentration of zinc also goes up, both total and dissolved. And then you can calculate that to mass loading, which is simply weight per volume, and get a load in kilograms, per time, kilograms per day or whatever. By doing these, and I'll show you an example here in a little bit of stream tracing, where you arrive at all this data. And this here, and I'm not going to go into this, this is David Mimick's work up in Montana, USGS. But by doing very detailed sampling along a stream, you can then look at cumulative inflow loads, total loads coming on along the stream, and you can learn a lot about the distribution of metals, where they're going to be. Are they going to be in the sediment? Are they going to be dissolved? Are they going to be sorbed somewhere? You can really learn a lot about that. So from an upfront end, you might have some sense of where these metals are going to be if there are releases from the mine site. This is mass loading again at the Leadville mine drain tunnel, and you can see the big spikes in zinc that came every May. I'm not going to go into the detail, but this really had to do with leachate from a surface waste rock pile getting into a shaft that then got into this tunnel, and that happens every spring in snowmelt, and we see this big jump in loading and then right back down to kind of a baseline number. So that's, again, a very seasonal variability sort of thing that has to be understood. Okay, switch to isotopes. I'm going through these kind of fast, but I want to introduce these tools. I'm available. I think my email's on here. Happy to answer questions on or offline about some of these tools. I just want to introduce you to these right now. Isotopes have become very important. We use them, and we get isotopic data on about every site we work on now. Very routine, the costs have come down, and they are very, very good for helping trace flow paths and understand the flow paths that are dominant in a catchment, and also for dating. So just the radioactive isotopes that are emitting alpha and beta particles over time, they decay, and that rate of decay gives us an age. And then the stable water isotopes like O18, deuterium, carbon-13, they really can help us identify and separate out different pathways that move groundwater around the catchment. This is an example, O18, O16. Really what we're talking about is the ratio of the O18 to the O16. Obviously, you can see that almost all oxygen occurs as O16. Isotopes are really atoms of the same element with a different number of neutrons, therefore they have a different mass. So the O18 is slightly heavier than the O16. That makes it preferential to drop out of the clouds. It just behaves slightly different than the O16. So the ratio of those two is what we measure. Okay, so let me give you some examples. These are the isotopes most commonly used, deuterium, oxygen, and those are collected and analyzed together. When you collect a sample for O18 and you send it off to the lab, you're going to get both of these. And then you plot one against the other. And then you can, that's a useful plot, and I'll show you one of those. Tritium is sort of changing. It's becoming a little less useful, or a little more complicated, I should say, because we put a whole bunch of tritium in the air in the late 50s, early 60s, and then we stopped. And so the amount is less, the baseline is less. Nevertheless, tritium is really good. If you get a sample with no tritium, you know one thing for sure. That water went into the ground prior to early 1950s. That's all you know, but you do know that. And then you can follow that up with some carbon dating, both inorganic carbon, dissolved organic carbon, to actually give an age. So tritium can help you decide which samples you want to send in for carbon, which is quite expensive relative to tritium. Sulfur-35 is an enormous amount of promise because it has a half-life of 87 days, not 12 years, or 5,700 years. So it is a tracer that would be very helpful for dating on this type of time scale. Unfortunately, it has constraints that make it less useful. It takes 20 gallons of water for a sample. That's a huge constraint. Also, it's affected by, it's a sulfur 35, so it's affected by sulfate. And sulfate is very common at mine sites, so you get a problem there. So it isn't really worked out yet. We're still in proof of concept there. Okay, just some examples. Again, these are 018 values here up in the upper left here from the Leadville site. These are all sampling locations that are groundwater and mine water locations here. Here's rain, it's quite enriched, actually, is the term we use for 018 relative to a standard, down around minus 10, minus 12. The snow, however, is very depleted, which is exactly what you'd expect in this latitude, in this elevation, minus 20. That means that's relative to a standard. So you can see the groundwater and the mine water line up pretty darn good. Again, telling us that the vast majority of the water we have to deal with in this mine pool and discharge is groundwater, not rain. And then down here in the lower right hand, you get some of these surface water that all plot a little more enriched. In the 018 game, the difference between minus 20 and minus 19 is huge. It's just very big. So we have a difference here. These surface water sites are down around minus 17. Groundwater sites are minus 19. So that's a significant difference. This is this Marion Shaft here, which was the center of the universe in Leadville for a while. Unlike all the other shafts, which are clearly groundwater, this shaft has a lot of surface water. And I won't go into, I don't have time to go into details, but that was a very important understanding in terms of how to prevent water from going into this and what water we had to deal with.
Hey, Mike,
another way to display the...
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mike. This is Michelle. I just want to let you know, do a time check. We have about three or four minutes left.
Okay. I'll scoot right through these then. Here's the deuterium 018 plot. And again, in this case, the mine water plotted exactly with the groundwater. You can also do spatial representation of this data. And then tritium, this is from Creed. These are all dead tritium down around less than one, very, very old water. So then we did carbon-14 here and found out this water is about 8 or 9,000 years old. This is a more normal tritium distribution from the LECO site where you see a lot more modern water. Okay, and then I'm going to finish with stream tracing since I'm going to run out of time. But I want to go through this and then we'll be done. This is a very good tool for helping to identify inflows to streams and for getting accurate stream flow and for looking for places where groundwater comes in. The idea is to inject a conservative tracer at a constant concentration and rate for an extended time to reach a plateau level. And then after you've done that, you sample very frequently on the stream for metals and other type, and for the tracer, lithium, bromide, those things. You get very accurate stream flow. You can locate groundwater inflows. And if you combine it with sediment data and flow data, you can get a lot more information out of this. Here's the plateau level you inject here at the upstream location. And then you achieve this all the way down, in this case, to 600 meters down. And you raise the concentration to this plateau level. This is an indication here of the difference stream flow measured by a discharge and a flow meter, and you miss it in mountain streams because of the hyperrhig zone. This is the real discharge, and there's quite a difference there, just to give an example. This is then a trace that the USGS did up in the Redwall Basin above Crested Butte, Colorado. This is a natural acidic spring here with a pH of about 4, and the question was, is this discharging a lot of acid to the stream, or is it coming from a couple of mine sites? That was the question. And we were able to figure that out. So they injected lithium chloride into this stream and then monitored the conductivity. And then after 24 hours, sampled the stream from bottom to top very frequently. And then we're able to plot that data. And we see that here. And we see the lithium concentration first. And any dilution or drop in the lithium concentration tells you you have an inflow. So here we had a mine inflow. Not very much water, didn't do much dilution. But here we had north-south structures, faults, and they discharged into the stream, and you can see a drop in the concentration. So they actually added quite a bit of water to the stream And then as you go on, you get more base flow into the stream and the concentrations go down. And then here, we were able to actually find, if you plot the pH at the same time, the effects of the mine, drop in pH, and then these structures, which we thought were bringing the spring water to the stream, you can see that they don't depress the pH at all. So the mine brought the low pH in the metal, even though we had an acidic spring nearby and there was water coming from that system into the stream, it wasn't delivering low pH water. So that was sort of the value of that. Okay, I think I'm going to stop there. Groundwater tracing, I've only got three slides left, so I'll just flip through them. But you can also inject organic dyes into the ground, and you can then recover those dyes, look for them at prescribed monitoring locations, and you really can empirically then determine where the groundwater flow paths are. So let me just show you the results, and I won't spend a lot of time. These are sort of our design where we put fluorocene, eucene, rhodamine dyes. This is the top of a mountain here, 2,000 feet of relief between here and the creek, and about a mile and a half, so keep that in mind. We injected three different dyes, looked at for those dyes in discharging portal and wells in the stream everywhere. Here are some of the plots. This is the eocene plot, so I just want to point out we got very nice breakthrough curves here, so we're confident in our data analysis. We know where these came out, the various dyes, and we see the breakthrough curves, so we're confident there. And then just one more breakthrough curve, and then finally here, final slide, this is what we learned. And so we could find where these individual dyes went in the ground, which flow paths. We had structure maps here, geologic maps. We knew the where the faults were. We knew where the jointed areas were. We tried to relate this flow to those. And what we learned was this. Unlike Connie's example where the water flowed along strike of the structure, it did that here until it intercepted another more permeable structure and then simply moved into that one. So with 2,000 feet of relief, what we found was a large portion of the dye injected at the top of the mountain ended up here, even though all the structures, the strike of the structures was like this. But all of our dye came in upstream here. So it's very similar to her example that way. And it stair-stepped its way down this mountain through various pathways that were permeable. And so it all came out here, not here where we thought it would. So just another example of sort of fracture flow and how all that works. So that's it. And went through that kind of fast. But again, I'm available and can be reached for any more information on any of these tools.
Great. Thanks, Mike. We have a few questions that have come in while you were speaking, so maybe we can answer one or two of them right now. One participant has noticed that you've identified many potential problems with using groundwater elevation maps in highly fractured systems. So mm-hmm. Due to this, have you seen more site characterization investigations incorporating geophysical methods, such as controlled source electromagnetic, to provide insight into preferential groundwater flow paths and seasonal variability? And if you have, do you have any comments on the uses of this kind of data?
We don't see it. I mean, I have seen some, but we don't see it very often. And the main reason is the expense. There's two reasons. One is the expense. But to get any kind of borehole information, whether it be geophysical information or pump test information or water quality information, you have to put the borehole in the right place. And so you got a chicken and egg problem here because sometimes until you develop the conceptual model to a point, you don't know where to put the boreholes. So if you get to that point and you know sort of where these preferential flow paths are likely to be, then I think those tools are quite valuable. We do use downhole flow meters, cameras, packers, all kinds of things to isolate fractures that are important or zones, vertical zones that are important to flow. And if you isolate those with packers, you can get a lot of information there. So yes, we see it, but not very much.
Okay. Great. We have a couple questions that have come in related to tracers, so I'm going to try to summarize these in one question or a series of questions related to tracers. The participants want to know how much tracer you inject and for how long you inject it, and then how much time is elapsed from the time you inject the dye. and to recover it in a stream, if any general information you have?
Those are good questions. On the stream tracing side, as I just showed you, you inject, bring these streams to a plateau level, and then you wait 24 hours. That's the standard methodology, then you send. On the groundwater side, it's a more of a challenging question, but it's a very good question. That's why I kept coming back to the conceptual model. You need to have some idea of where to go look for this tracer. It cannot be random. You can't just go out there and look. So I always say to folks, tracing is not the first characterization effort you make in these watershed. You do other things first. You have to know enough to trace. And what I mean by that is, what are the likely pathways? What are the likely receptors? What's the time of travel that you might expect? Because you can't wait there 3 years to recover your tracer. I know this. I've done that. So you, all that stuff has to be developed before you do that. On the amount, any dye tracer, if you've worked with dye tracers, they have to go to therapy if their dye isn't recovered. They just don't like that. So their inclination is the old adage, if some is good, more is better. So they use a lot is the answer. They use a lot.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mike, for a great presentation. I think in the interest of time, we're going to move on to our third presenter. So Bob Thompson, you can take your phone off mute, and you'll see that I've given you presenter rights, and your slide deck and photo have shown up. So just so everyone knows who you are, Bob. Bob has 35 years of experience working for the Forest Service as a geologist and a district ranger. His mineral experience includes large and small operations, both on the technical minerals examination side and in permitting and administration. So today we're going to have Bob talk to us about mining on National Forest System land. So are you all good to go, Bob?
I'm good to go.
Great.
Yes, thank you. Those are some great presentations. I sure learned a lot. I had to think quite a bit, though. So the easy part for you now is I have a very simple presentation. It's not technical. It's not going to hurt your brain. Unfortunately, I have no pretty pictures, maps, cross-sections, or figures. So it might be a little dry for you, but I want to give you all a perspective. Some of you may have it, but dealing with mining operations on national forests, and we'll just kind of walk through it in a very general way. So let me see here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about legal authorities, approval process, other agency involvement, mitigation, monitoring, adaptive management, and reclamation. And I'll be going through that fairly quickly here. 1872 mining laws amended. I'm sure most folks have heard about the mining law. There's actually three different types of minerals that we deal with. There's locatable minerals, there's leasable minerals, and there's saleable minerals. What we call locatable minerals are those that are covered under the 1872 mining law. And that's kind of the overall law that gives folks the right to prospect, explore, and develop on public lands. The Organic Act, 1897 Organic Act, that's what established the direction for the Forest Service, gave the Secretary of Agriculture, which we're in as opposed to Interior, the authority to establish regulations to manage national forest system lands. Multiple Use Minerals Act was a law, came in 1955. It removed a number of what we call common variety minerals from being locatable under the mining law. But another thing that it did is it clarified and established pretty clearly what the Forest Service role in managing surface uses is when you're dealing with mining claims and mining uses. And I do want to point out that with Forest Service, we're not managing the mineral. We're managing the surface resource and anything that could affect the surface resource. And then our regulations are in 36 CFR 228. Subpart A deals with the locatable minerals, and that provides our process for how we review projects, how we end up permitting them, if you will, and all of the other steps in there, which I'll be getting to here in a minute. Approval process. Way it works is obviously somebody's been out there looking for minerals. We probably have dealt with them numerous times through NEPA and other processes for their exploration drilling. Hopefully by the time they get to this point where they're submitting a mine proposal, they've also collected quite a bit of baseline data. So those things are very important. And then we get to the part where the two presentations we previously had, this is where we, when we get to the NEPA analysis, where we're determining issues, alternatives, and effects, that's where we're plugging in all the information that the two previous presentations talked about, understanding the groundwater systems in this case and the surface water systems, but that's true for all the other resources. After we get through NEPA, and y'all know if you've ever been tied in or involved with it, it can be a very long and detailed and expensive process. Our regulations don't give us the authority to just outright say no and reject mining, but it does require that surface effects are minimized where feasible and in compliance with all the other laws that are on the books. Our decisions, they are appealable, so folks can appeal our decisions internally, and after that, if they want, they can take them to court. And That happens with fairly regular frequency. We establish mitigation, monitoring, and reclamation requirements, and then a reclamation bond is required before anybody's going to be operating. So there's all kinds of other laws, obviously, all kinds of other agencies. Many of you may work for them, whether it be federal, state, or local. These efforts that we do with our analysis and our permitting, they're usually group shoots. They're Forest Service is typically the lead or a co-lead agency dealing with NEPA, but often we have one or more state or federal cooperating agencies. Often from one NEPA document, there could be a number of decisions made, not just by the Forest Service, but other agencies. Corps of Engineers comes to mind with a 404 permit. So we have a number of different permits, obviously, folks need to deal with. Pollution discharge elimination system, state construction and facility permits, 401 certification. 404 permits, which I mentioned, stormwater pollution prevention plans, they have to have approval for that. So we're almost always working in partnership, which is great because many other agencies and other entities have got expertise that really helps us do a better job managing the public's lands. When we're looking at the options that might be approved, we working with the company, working with other agencies, we ensure that we develop design standards and mitigation standards that are going to minimize the impacts by limiting the degree and magnitude of the action. Might rectify an impact by repairing or rehabilitating or restoring. It might reduce or eliminate an impact over time in how we do maintenance and what those requirements are. Or we might look at compensating for an impact by replacing habitats, for example. A grizzly bear comes to mind in some projects in northwest Montana where the grizzly bear critical habitat that was going to be affected needed to be replaced, so new land was bought. A number of folks here might have worked with wetlands compensation in the past. If you're going to affect wetlands, you're going to need to replace those. So there's a number of mitigations that get put into place. Monitoring, and that really gets down a lot of what's been talked about here today really gets into the monitoring side of things. Scope and the scale of monitoring is obviously going to depend on the size of the operation, which resources might be affected. Monitoring typically contains very detailed monitoring plan, covers things such as what is it that you're actually monitoring, who's going to do the monitoring, where are you going to do it, how's it going to be measured, what kind of quality control you have in place, the frequency and the reporting requirements. So these are things, if we're not out there monitoring all those wonderful things we thought we understood, and groundwater clearly is one of those items, we may find out that we didn't have quite the understanding that we had, that the effects may be different, especially you're talking about the fractured pathways that water might move around. We might not have understood things well enough, and monitoring is one of the tools that we use, and it's critical to make sure that the effects are as we thought. And then we get into the adaptive management part, and Connie's talk, she talked about reevaluating as more information becomes available, and that's really what adaptive management is. We take that monitoring data, we determine if and when it's necessary to require adjustments to operating procedures, new mitigations that might be required, maybe some additional monitoring or different types of monitoring, so that we can determine if corrective actions are needed. And we have the ability under our regulations to require the operator then to modify their operation based on what we're finding out here through the monitoring, and then dealing with adaptive management to figure out what needs to be changed. And then the last item I'm going to talk about here is reclamation. Years back, I mean, we all know some of the legacy of mining in the country. Practices were obviously different than they are today and what they're required. But improved operations should include both interim and final reclamation requirements. And the interim reclamation is sometimes you get operations that shut down for a period of time, and they maybe because of market conditions, metal prices go south, or some other business reason. But the intention is to come back. Obviously, you're not going to reclaim the whole project, but you clearly want to stabilize and deal with any issues that you have during that interim closure. Good example of one I can think of is the Troy mine up in northwest Montana, copper-silver underground mine, and it was closed for a period of time. Metal prices recovered, and they reopened the mine. Final reclamation, obviously, is when you've exhausted the mineral resource and it's time to close things up. Our reclamation requirements, they typically include, and these come right out of our regulations, reclaiming the surface disturbance, preventing and controlling on-site and off-site damage to the environment. Obviously, we don't want erosion and the like. So control of erosion and landslides, control of water runoff, isolation, removal and control of toxic materials, that clearly gets to a lot of what today's talks were about. Obviously, there's a number of potential sources and pathways for having toxic materials from a mining operation. Reshaping and revegetating disturbed areas where reasonably practical, and rehabilitation of fisheries and wildlife habitat. And the way that we ensure that reclamation is going to be conducted is we need financial assurance to ensure that. And often, most states that we work with, the states also have rules that deal with bonding and reclamation, and so typically we work with the state to have one bond wherever possible so that we're not duplicating our efforts. And I think that's what I have. I tried to move through there quickly because I know time is escaping.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bob. We have quite a few questions that have come in while you were speaking, so I think we have time to address some of these. We have a participant who wants to know that if initial predictions noted no impact to water quality and monitoring, or and monitoring showed potential water quality impacts, do we require the operator to adjust their reclamation plan and adjust bonding requirements for long-term water treatment?
That obviously depends what we find out, but we do have the ability when we see things that we did not expect to request modifications to that plan, to change the reclamation requirements and reclamation bonds, and to make what changes are needed. So it's really going to depend on what it is we see in terms of the degree of change that's required out there.
Okay. We have a questioner who wants to know if the Forest Service is required to still conduct the NEPA analysis if the proposed mining activity occurs on land owned by the Forest Service and non-federal minerals.
So in other words, it's private minerals and it's National Forest public surface?
That's what it sounds like from the question, yes.
Okay. I would give you an answer, but I could easily be wrong on that because most of my experience has dealt with both the mineral and the surface estate belonging to the Forest Service.
Okay.
I do know that there's requirements. If somebody has the mineral estate, they have a strong basis for being able to operate. I just don't know how NEPA works in that case.
Okay, that's fine. Another person once makes a statement that since treaties are the law of the land in Indian ceded territory, how does the Forest Service EA-EIS address this?
Well, every NEPA document that I'm aware of addresses those types of issues. Most tribes, certainly any tribes that have had interest in areas over time, they are tied in and involved in government-to-government discussions in terms of potential effects. So they're notified and they're asked to consult with the Forest Service in this particular case, as well as heritage-type resources, which could be historic, basically from settlement onward, as well as prehistoric. I've never particularly liked that term, but it deals with prior to settlement. So that's always a big issue as we're dealing with things. But consultation with the tribes is ongoing on most any large mining operation that I know of where there's potential effects.
Okay. So, Bob, can you talk a little bit more about replacing wetlands and at what point is there a limit to how much replacement can be considered and who looks at the whole region for impacts that are compounded?
Well, you know, that's where it gets into the whole with the Corps and other parties that are dealing with 404 permits and those wetland requirements tend to be requirements that go along with that, which is kind of a no net loss policy, is my understanding. So in terms of size and whatever, I'm not sure if there is a size that way. I know about 20 years ago or so, I was working on one where it was an acre per acre needed to replace it, and that could have either been purchasing private and requiring that it be protected, or it could have been even kind of creating a new wetland habitat.
Okay. We are getting up close to the end of our webinar, but I think I would like to give you one or two more questions, Bob, since we are getting a lot of activity here. This participant wants to know if you can discuss what elements go into an adaptive management plan. Do you have corrective actions predetermined so that you can respond easily?
You know, a number of the EISs that are being done now, you kind of almost get into a formalized plan where you look at different triggers. I don't know if I could tell you in the time that we have here exactly what that is, and I think it depends so much on the specific project. As we were talking today, everything is obviously different. But a good monitoring plan is required in order to establish what some of the adaptive approaches would be. And often they're laid out more in terms of possibilities as opposed to we'll go to this point and that point, because you really don't know what the information you're going to collect is going to tell you. So they point you in a direction, but they're not a go to this step, go to that step, go to that step type of an approach.
Okay. Why don't we take one last question here before we close out. This participant wants to know if the Forest Service has ever held a bond to cover any future problems that may be observed in monitoring post-mining.
You know, again, I'm not sure if I could answer that in terms of, normally when you're dealing with bonds, you're dealing with something that you can identify in some sense, as opposed to, you know, kind of waving your arm about something that might happen in the future. The key with bonding is it's not just a one-time thing so that when you first start the operation, you set it. It's the kind of thing you can revisit over time. And when you have all the information, when you're getting towards closure, for example, it's at that time that you're really double and triple checking to make sure that you got things covered based on your understandings. But it's hard to bond for things that you really don't know what they are.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank all of our presenters today, Connie, Mike, and Bob. I think this is a great complement to this workshop series. And I hope that all of you really gained a lot of information from this and that you'll participate again in our next webinar, which you'll see is listed here on this slide. Workshop 3 is March 5th at 1 o'clock, and there's a link to the registration here. So please join us on March 5th, and thanks for your attention today. I think you all see Jean is back, so we're going to have her go through a little closeout for us on today's webinar.
Thank you very, very much, Michelle. So I'm going to go ahead and move everybody through a couple of closing items and reminders before we formally shut today's session down. I want to point people to some important resources, including where you can follow us to find out more information about what we do on CLUE, and if you're interested in getting alerted about new training opportunities or when archives become available from sessions just like this, I'd encourage you to visit our website or connect with us on one of our popular professional and social networking sites. Most importantly, though, a number of people have asked for copies of the presentation materials or some of the references that have been highlighted by our presenters, and you can find copies of the materials, again, on the seminar homepage. We also have an entire listing of resources and references related to today's presentation. So I'd encourage you guys to take a moment to browse that related resources page. That's hyperlinked underneath my live video in the related URLs pod. And you also find it on the seminar homepage. There's a button that'll say related links and resources. You can find the materials that were discussed today on that website. If you have a moment, I'd encourage everybody to take a chance to look at the short feedback form that we have available. That's also available under seminar feedback in the related URLs window below my live video feed. The feedback form takes just a moment to fill out. I do read each and every one of the responses that comes through, and I want to thank everybody if you've already taken a moment to fill that out. Thank you again. We do appreciate your comments, and we rely upon your feedback to help us to continue to improve sessions like this online and deliver these seminars for free. If you're filling out the feedback form and you shared the line with multiple parties, each individual person can actually fill their own feedback form out. Once you fill it out once, there's a link to let someone else fill out their own feedback form, and each person can actually do that. If you don't have time to fill it out now, that's okay. The feedback form is up and will be open indefinitely, so you can come back to the feedback form later on. And in fact, if you're one of the people watching this as a recorded version,